From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Blanc.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Welcome to Recovery Summer. At least that's what the White House is calling it. The Obama administration is pouring billions of dollars into summer construction projects, hoping to get Americans back to work. To highlight the effort, President Obama joined a group of hard hat construction workers in Ohio today. He was there to break ground on a road improvement project funded by economic stimulus money. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The groundbreaking near Nationwide Children's Hospital in downtown Columbus marks the beginning of the 10,000th road improvement project funded by the stimulus. President Obama says pouring all that concrete and widening all those lanes has created a lot of needed jobs, both directly and indirectly.
They've put thousands of construction crews, just like this one, to work. They've spurred countless small businesses to hire because, you know, these are some big guys here, so they got to eat, which means that you got to get some food brought in, or the local restaurants here benefit from the crews being here at work.
But the president acknowledged many more jobs are needed, with national unemployment still at 9.7%, and Ohio's jobless rate even higher. This summer, the nature of stimulus spending will shift away from preserving jobs in state and local government towards more public works. There will be six times as many highway projects as last summer, eight times as many national parks projects, and 20 times as many water projects.
Instead of worrying about where their next paycheck is going to come from, Americans across the country are helping to build our future and their own futures.
But pollster Michael Dimmock of the Pew Research Center says the administration has a political problem. Americans don't believe all that asphalt the government's paying for is putting us on the road to recovery.
The public doesn't feel we've turned the corner yet. They're still pretty gloomy about the state of the economy, and they're skeptical that the stimulus plan passed last year has really made much of a difference.
In a Pew survey this month, more people said they think the president's policies are hurting the economy than making it better. The largest group think the policies haven't made much difference. In fact, many independent economists say the stimulus has helped to revive the economy and prevent even bigger job losses. But Vice President Biden, who oversees the program, says it's totally understandable that many Americans don't see it that way.
It's real simple. The measurement is it feeling better? Am I more confident? Can I go, instead of getting my hair cut every 7 weeks, can I go back to getting it done once a month or once every 3 weeks? Can I take a vacation? Am I going to buy this car? Do I feel better I'm going to be able to make my mortgage payment?
The administration is planning a high-visibility campaign this summer to promote stimulus projects, with more televised groundbreakings and a lot of Recovery Act logos posted along freeways and in national parks. Dimmock cautions the Recovery Summer campaign could be a double-edged sword.
Seeing those signs may remind people the government is taking steps to try to help the economy and provide jobs, but it also reminds people the government's spending a lot of money, and that's not so popular right now.
Indeed, concern about government spending is so strong, the Senate was unable to muster the votes this week to extend unemployment benefits. The government doesn't have a lot of time to change people's attitudes about the economy. Recovery summer will be closely followed by midterm election autumn. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
Today, I return to Columbus to mark a milestone on the road to recovery, the 10,000th project launch under the Recovery Act. That's worth a big round of applause.
President Obama speaking in Ohio on Friday, touting the administration's stimulus plan. James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic, and he joins us here most Saturdays. Jim, welcome back from 2 weeks in China.
Thank you very much, Guy.
Let's start with jobs. Unemployment, of course, is hovering at around 9%. The Democrats seem either unwilling or afraid to push for a job stimulus bill. They're, of course, worried about adding to the deficit and the perception of adding to the deficit. At the same time, Jim, NPR released a poll this past week that shows that Democrats are in deep trouble going into the midterms. How much is the jobless question a problem for the Democrats in Congress and for the White House?
Of course, it's a big problem. And part of this is the eternal challenge that any administration faces. This is very much the same situation that Ronald Reagan had 2 years into his term in 1982, where on the one hand, we judge presidents in the long run by the big things they take on, the big things they accomplish or don't. On the other hand, when each election rolls around, especially these midterms, it usually is the jobless rate that's the most powerful single variable. That's why James Carville is so famous for "It's the economy, stupid," as his motto. And so the challenge for the president and the administration is to be consistent with their long-term goals while also attending to the thing which will make most difference in their prospects this year. I think there's one other thing here to mention, which is the confused U.S. discussion of the term deficits. Certainly, everybody agrees that in the long run, deficits for the U.S. government or others really matter. But in the short term, in times of economic downturn, it's the lack of deficits that's most significant for getting people back to work. Somebody compared this to worrying about your furniture getting wet when firemen are trying to put out a fire in your house, that in the short term, it's a shortage of deficits, which actually should be more worrisome.
Jim, turning to China now, earlier today, the country's central bank announced it may allow its currency, the renminbi, to float more freely against the dollar. What kind of impact could that have? I mean, could it, for example, make American manufacturers more competitive against their Chinese counterparts?
In the short run, probably not. I've spent, as you and I have discussed, I spent a lot of time in the factories of southern China. I was there again just last week. And the cost differential between Chinese wage rates and the rest of the world is still so great. And the infrastructure advantage that Chinese manufacturers have with their ports and their highways and their airports and all the rest is so sort of well developed that in the short run, I think there probably are going to be zero jobs that will come right back to Ohio or Michigan if the RMB starts to move again, the Chinese currency. But over the next months and the next years, this should be a move towards a larger balance of China's chronic exports and chronic surplus with the deficits elsewhere, including the U.S.
Finally, Jim, to the oil spill and BP, everyone from the White House to members of Congress seems to be pointing to BP as the sole culprit here. But I wonder, Jim, whether that's too convenient. I mean, we all buy oil. We all in America have sort of become dependent on cheap oil. The government basically subsidizes it. Is it fair to put all of this on one company alone? Is that too easy?
Sure. And like most things we talk about in politics, it is too easy. And if we didn't need so much oil, if we didn't need so much energy, we wouldn't need so much from BP and so much from these deep ocean wells, et cetera. So I think using this episode as an occasion for a shift in energy policy is important. On the other hand, I am impressed not just by the testimony in the last week or so in the Congress with the hapless CEO Hayward from BP, but also interviews I've had with people from other oil industry companies saying that there were things BP did which really weren't industry standard. You have Halliburton talking about risks BP took. You have Shell officials talking about this, number of other companies. So I think we need to look to ourselves in the long run, but I think BP also has more than just a sort of accidental bystander role here.
That's James Fallows of The Atlantic. You can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks again. Welcome back.
Thank you, Guy.
And when we talk about the financial crisis, we often hear about inadequate regulation, greedy bankers, irresponsible consumers. University of Chicago economist Raghu Rajan points to another cause, social inequality. He says disparity in income is one of the fault lines that contributed to the recent financial earthquake. Rajan's new book is called Fault Lines, and he joined us to talk about it.
This wasn't the typical boom and bust that characterizes the housing economy. This was a boom where the poorest people and their houses went up the most in price and came down the most. And I point to income inequality. The problem in the United States is that incomes for people with college degrees has grown much faster than incomes of those only with high school degrees. And the reason really is that technology implies that people today require much more of an education in order to the jobs that are available. But the supply of the educated is not keeping pace with the demand for them. As a result, people who have the education are growing much richer than people who don't.
So you're not talking about the very rich. You're talking about middle class, maybe upper middle class, versus people who are what we might call working class.
Absolutely. And I'm saying the people in the working class need a better education, but education is very hard to fix. So with the American middle class slipping behind, there's immense pressure on the politicians to do something. The buttons that were easy for them to push was more credit, because some of the institutions that offer credit, especially in housing, were affiliated or controlled by the government. Now, what I want to argue is that housing credit became a palliative, which had support from both the left and the right. And so you had President Clinton talking about the affordable housing mandate. You had President Bush talking about the ownership society. But both pushed government agencies and the quasi-government agencies to send a lot of money towards low-income housing. And that did push up housing prices a lot at the lower end and eventually led to a collapse in those prices.
You draw comparisons to history. In particular, I'm thinking the 1910s and 1920s, the years leading up to the stock market crash that
Absolutely.
Kicked off the Great Depression.
We had another big transformation towards the end of the 19th century. And again, at that time, you had a rise in inequality and you had the farmers falling behind. And at that time, the farmers pushed again politically for more credit. And the outcome was an expansion in banking, a tremendous expansion in banking in the early part of the 20th century. And in many ways, the farm sector was a subprime sector of the Great Depression. There were lots of farm foreclosures. The Grapes of Wrath is a classic book on that phenomenon. And many banks who had lent to these farmers again went out of business. So this is not a new phenomenon in U.S. history. And instead of doing the things that are needed to make society transition towards a better distribution of income, we use credit to fill the gap.
You've just spoken about one fundamental problem or fault line. What would be another one?
Well, the second fault line I want to talk about is the fact that the recovery from recessions has become much more prolonged, especially in terms of jobs. Because the United States has very narrow safety nets or very limited safety nets, there's a tremendous amount of anxiety created amongst the unemployed. There's huge anxiety, while in Spain, they endure 20% unemployment without a revolution or without the kind of anxiety that we have here. So the point I'm trying to make here is the nature of U.S. recessions were compatible with the U.S. safety net in the past. Quick recessions, short safety net. Now what has happened is that with the recessions, at least the jobless part of it, lasting much longer, the safety net is inadequate. And we have to think about this, whether we can afford the kinds of policies that come in to substitute for the safety net, policies that expand the deficit widely, policies that lead to very low interest rates for a sustained period in a somewhat futile attempt to get firms to hire.
Raghu Rajan is a professor at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. His new book is Fault Lines. Like so many American homeowners, the city of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, is underwater, deeply in debt, with no easy or clear way out. NPR's Tamara Keith has this report on how that happened.
Most of Harrisburg's financial troubles can be traced here. The city incinerator, officially called the Harrisburg Resource Recovery Facility. It converts trash into power, but over the years, what it's done best is burn cash. Jim Klecko is a regional vice president for Covanta Energy, the company under contract to operate the facility.
There's nothing in the industry that even reflects the type of financial structure that this facility is in.
While many of the nation's incinerators are nearly paid off, the one in Harrisburg is nearly $300 million in the hole. It's the result of years of bad decisions and bad luck. Klecko says the facility is working better now than it ever has, even operating at a profit. That is, if you don't count the debt.
If you ran at peak efficiency 100% all of the time, just by sheer volume, you couldn't process that much waste in a facility of this size to make their debt service.
The total debt service owed this year by the Harrisburg Authority, which owns all of the city's utilities, is $68 million. But the authority has been missing incinerator payments left and right, so the responsibility falls to the city of Harrisburg, which backed the bonds. Problem is, the city can't handle the bills either. It's already missed a couple of payments this year.
Bankruptcy sounds bad, I think, but when you are insolvent, when you have very little, few options,
this may be actually the best option.
Dan Miller is the city controller, and he says that $68 million bill for the incinerator is more than the entire city general fund budget. So how did a city get to the point where it owes significantly more than it could possibly pay? The same way a lot of people do. They borrowed irresponsibly.
It's like taking something from one credit card to another credit card to another credit card, and you keep getting a little more and a little more.
The facility was built in the early 1970s and had problems almost from the start. In 2003, regulators shut it down because of environmental violations. But it was deeply in debt at the time, and city leaders decided the only way out was to sell more bonds and rebuild and expand the incinerator. Harrisburg Mayor Linda Thompson was on the city council at the time. She says the former mayor and various outside consultants made a strong case.
They sold us the fact that this incinerator, once it's retrofitted, would make enough money to pay the old debt and the new debt. And unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Instead, the contractor left the project unfinished and filed for bankruptcy. So the city and the Harrisburg Authority were out another $125 million and still didn't have an operating incinerator. That led to another round of bonds, which gets us back to today.
Someone should have said enough, and it wasn't. So here we are.
Mayor Thompson says she's working to secure a forbearance agreement to give the city time to figure out what to do next.
Bankruptcy is not on the table as a first option. It will be the last option if we have to get there. But right now, we're working on quite a number of other steps before we get to bankruptcy.
Thompson is talking about signing a long-term lease for city parking structures, a plan that would bring in a big chunk of cash now, but would eliminate a future source of revenue. And most significantly, she's hoping to restructure the city's debt, sort of a refinance on a large scale. She says this is about saving the city of Harrisburg. Tamara Keith, NPR News.